Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode one of Smart Manufacturing, New Opportunities for Growth. I'm so excited to introduce you to your instructor. Oh, by the way, my name is Adam Barricato, and I'm an instructional designer at Purdue. So, Kathy, I'm very curious, what are you most excited about in this first chapter, in this first week of your course? What are the things that you're hoping students will really get a grasp of and really start to get excited about?
Well, I've taught this course for a long time. This is the first opportunity I've had to really apply it to a unique situation. I've taught it in distribution and how it works in vertical channels, and I've taught it in manufacturing technology systems. But here we're looking really at the drivers for moving into smart manufacturing. And so, and this is a finance class, and we teach all of the tools that can do that very, very well. And we'll go step by step, just like any standard finance class, but it'll give us a chance to think about some bigger pictures too. You really can't talk about smart manufacturing without thinking about strategy, for example, of the company. How do we go to business? How do we go to market? Who are the key partners that we're going to play with to do this? What's our balance sheet look like, our income statements? What kind of financial health are we in? You really can't begin a big process like this without knowing that very well. We get to get down to brass tacks and think about a real smart manufacturing process. That's, you know, and I'll talk more about this later, but it's not just one element that we're looking there for. I mean, it's the people context. It's the context of our manufacturing environment. It's our competitors and where are they? It's our raw material suppliers. We could go on and on with the kinds of things, not to mention the man-machine integration thing. And again, I'll talk more about these things as we go, but this is an opportunity for us to teach you to be better analysts and prognosticators, if you will, about how smart manufacturing, in fact, can be budgeted for, planned for, that you can figure out exactly what you're trying to get out of these projects.
So is this a finance course?
It is a finance course. Yeah.
Now, what if I'm not good at finance?
Oh, what? Everybody's good at finance. Maybe not everybody's been taught finance, or maybe not everybody's spent time, you know, reading and listening to finance. But look, I've had all kinds of math, and I think that's really what people hear when they hear finance. I'm not good at math. I can't do this. I think finance is one of the easiers of the math. And I've had calculus. I've had, you know, pretty much every physics, every kind of math you can think of. This is my favorite by far, because it's straightforward and you can apply every element that we learn in finance to your own household, for goodness sakes, to buying a house, to do a new residential project that you've got. This will make you a better consumer, a better financial manager in your own home. This is a valuable course for you, not to mention the value that it'll have to you, whether you're a project manager, a manufacturing plant manager, or sitting on a board of directors. And we will talk about those kinds of decisions that they make. I've sat on quite a few of them, and these tools are the ways that they make decisions in those boardrooms. It's important.
Yeah. Could you go in a little bit of detail about how companies are using finance concepts to make decisions about smart manufacturing?
Well, companies use finance to make decisions about everything, you know, and that's true whether they're typically a small company, you know, maybe even a single operator, you know, they've still got to do their profits and taxes every year like the rest of us, and typically have an attorney working with them somewhere. But we are in major corporations looking at finances, you know, on a deep dive, at least on a quarterly basis. At least every board I've ever been on works that way. And so, you know, kind of where you are. But when you're talking about a smart manufacturing project, now you're talking about a capital budgeting process that involves a lot of dollars, a lot of space, perhaps fixed, you know, equipment that's very large investment. These are the kinds of things that we're going to tear down and break down one at a time. But you're going to see throughout this course and by the end of the course, how you yourself could think about it and perhaps sell to your bosses an idea for smart manufacturing. And let's remember smart manufacturing, and I know you know this by now, but it's we're not talking about going directly typically to a lights out, you know, manufacturing operation where everything is done automated. Typically, there's a spectrum, right, of smart manufacturing, and often it involves, you know, human interaction of some sort, cobots working together. Those are all stages that we go through in this element towards smart manufacturing. And quite frankly, some places it doesn't make sense to go fully automated. You know, there's people situations to think about. There's raw material quality that comes in that might mean that, you know, we really do need some human interaction here watching this smart manufacturing system that we've got going. Those have to be planned for and engineered upfront, maybe before even the capital budgeting plans go, so that we have some idea of where we're going. And we got to know what things to monitor and watch for as we go too. There's no such thing as a perfect capital budget, in my opinion, but we can sure improve our odds for success with this kind of planning.
So, Kathy, I was curious as I was thinking about that. I mean, what about for, like, let's just say here in Indiana, right? There's a ton of, what would you call them, small to medium size enterprises or manufacturing plants, right? What makes them different than, like, say, Caterpillar, right? So a Caterpillar can say, okay, well, we're just going to add, you know, let's say X amount of sensors, right? Like, to them, it's no big deal. But for these smaller, you know, manufacturing companies, how does finances play a role? I mean, I would think it'd be different.
Well, different in the sense that it's probably a smaller investment that they're making. On the other hand, if I'm a small owner and I'm looking at this, that may be a huge investment on a relative scale to what I have to spend. And it's also a big change in terms of what does my manufacturing process look like? How do I plan for this? Am I going to work with some system integrator to get here and teach me to do it? Or am I going to hire a grad student out of a place like Purdue to come and help me implement that? And I've done both. I've seen both of those things done. You know, and we got great resources at Purdue to help small manufacturing organizations figure out how to work these things. But when you're doing it for the first time, there's a steep learning curve, not just for, you know, the folks involved in developing this new process, adding these sensors, but the employees that are working there. We have to be able to think about planning. We've got to think about implementation of purchasing processes, implementation, testing, you know, and then continuing to monitor to see how that works. There's a lot of stages for even a small company involved in a relatively small smart manufacturing process. On the other hand, I can think of no better way to do things like this than to add some sensors of some sorts or some barcode triggers or whatever it might be, you know.
So then my question to you is, as we, you know, now that you've done a great job of giving us the big picture, let's kind of zoom in, you know, to this first chapter, you know, this first week. Talk to us a little bit about these big tools that you're talking about, these big ideas that we're kind of learning about, like cash flow cycle. And you use the word capital budget decision a lot. Can you give us some more insight into that and how that kind of applies to what we're going to be doing in this course?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch here because we could go into an awful lot of details about what you're thinking about, but in a cash flow cycle, you know, you've got to think about where your money is coming in at any given time in the organization and where it's going out. And as I begin a new process, obviously I've got employees that I'm paying, I've got new production processes that money is funneling into. And if I've done some work in forecasting, I have a good sense of what kind of labor, raw materials, time is going to be needed for any new process. And even with that new project that I'm doing, I'm going to have that forecast there and have a sense of, okay, how much money is literally going to be going out daily, weekly, monthly out of this cycle. And then as that production cycle moves on around, it goes into, you know, from work in process to finished goods material, and whether I move it out to distribution or I'm selling this direct to somebody, I've got to think about, okay, how long is it going to be before I get my cash back? You know, we don't literally stop and think very often about how much from the time I begin this manufacturing process and I start penny-anting all kinds of cash out there to when I finally make a sale, and later, at least 30 days from the time they get that bill, get my money back. I want you to understand there is a big loop that flows around and around. And that's it is, in a sense, how much working cash is keeping my operation flowing. All right. And sometimes I end up with more working capital moving through there than I have cash coming out the other side from the sales. Right. And so there's a sense of balancing that, particularly if I'm a, we'll get into this later, but what if I'm a real seasonal deal, but yet I've got a capacity, I've got to fill, I got to keep my production process going all year round. But I'm really not going to sell that until I get a little closer to summer or Christmas. All of those things make a big, big difference in terms of where I'm going to really get my return on cash. So I got to have enough cash right up front to make this work. I got to plan for when that's going to start coming back and know that I have the working capital there to do it. So in smart manufacturing, that means any new investment in smart manufacturing is going to some degree, have to help pay for itself. Is this going to make me more efficient? Is this going to make me more reliable as a system? Am I going to maybe be able to speed that process up in terms of the manufacturing and get my cash flow going faster because it doesn't take as long to manufacture? You know, those are the kinds of things that you might be able to solve or to help in this whole cash flow process. By the way, that's just the cash flow things, elements related to, say, a smart production system. And there's many more in any company. Obviously, you got to keep the lights on and the hedges trimmed and people paid and things like that. So if you look at a cash flow cycle, and I think we'll do that in detail in chapter 7, but I'll post that for you here in week 1 too. You'll be able to see as we go, where do real expenses go over time? And where do our cash receipts start coming in? We'll do a cash budget later and you'll actually see how to plan for that cash flow.
So it sounds like these tools are really helping us to make a decision.
Yes. In fact, all of these financial tools help you make decisions month to month in organizations. Year to year, usually budgets are set at the beginning of whatever fiscal year you use. It's not always January to December-ish, as you, probably many of you know. But there will be income statements, balance sheets, statements of retained earnings. We'll look at all of those so you'll know how to read, you know, what are the assets in these companies? You'll even understand where our biggest fixed costs are. We're leveraged to the hilt here because we have a lot of fixed equipment. Well, that means I've got to produce and I can make more money with that leverage, that operational leverage, unless things go south. And if I'm not in capacity, then I'm going to go down really quickly. I want you to understand that alone, looking at these financial statements and balance sheets, helps us understand risk, the risk that we're taking. It's really to a great degree for any company, whether it's the small company in, you know, Indiana, right here in West Lafayette, we've got plenty of them, or you're in, you know, actually over on the Lafayette side, we've got some really big plants over there. All of them have to consider, you know, where are we now? Where are we going? What's the risk we're going to take? How much money can we put in this? What can our people handle? What kind of tree do they have? And there's a point at which there's almost a problem with too much automation, particularly if it's not highly reliable. What happens if your employees begin to get too complacent? And there is a problem they either don't know how to intervene or can't intervene appropriately because they really don't know the system well enough to do it. Those are some of the breaking points or information states, I should say growth stages that companies going into automation will go through.
Yeah. So big picture, what would you say is the criterion for a successful business decision to integrate smart manufacturing?
Well, we're going to look at capital budgeting and we'll teach three tools that are commonly used every day. One thing is the old payback method. And while people sometimes are dismissive of this, my dad was a CEO. All they ever really depended on was, you know, is this going to make us a return on investment? But let me tell you, remember several years ago when biotechnology was the big rage, and those were 20-year projects that they were looking at and putting out a lot of money. Many of them went under because they had such a long payback that they couldn't get the money back in order to make that work. So payback is literally, how long does it take me to get my initial investment back in terms of revenues being generated out of that project? So if that's 6 months or a year or 2 years or even maybe 5 years for a very large company, that's not a bad deal. 10, 15, 20 years, like some of these biotech companies, while they were ahead of their time, they were brilliant and doing great things. Many of them couldn't make it until they were success in the marketplace. And so they'd go under. There's another element of risk there that you're talking about.
Can you give us a smart manufacturing example? Like the biotech industry is a great example of the payback, but do you have like another example that you can offer?
Well, robotics is a big one going on right now. And as I mentioned before, there's lots of reasons to go to robots. And it's kind of fun for me. I love to watch, you know, things like 60 Minutes. I'll give them a plug because they've done quite a bit on robotics and drones, things like that at different times. And so I watched one and I get the privilege of interviewing candidates for our tenure track positions. And many of these people are really brilliant with robots and doing research in that area. I got in conversation with one last semester. And I said, sounds like cobots is the way to go. And she said, oh, they're everywhere. Companies are using cobots. That's robots with people to get things done in a manufacturing plant. Great smart manufacturing move. It is. You can see exactly why. You can increase reliability. You could limit quite the amount of physical lifting, for example, moving from space to space. Cobots are a great environment. But if I think about what can go wrong in a cobot environment, my first thought was, oh, man, they're going to knock me down, cut my head off, weld something to my head, you know, because I'm human and I'll be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or their sensor will go bad. And like so many disasters we've seen with self-driving cars, sooner or later, that kind of stuff can happen. One of these experts in it said, well, would you expect that there's going to be fewer injuries for employees or more? I said, I'm assuming there's going to be fewer. She said, it's the opposite. And it has nothing to do with what you just said, Kathy. It has to do with the fact that robots aren't human. They move faster than humans can. They move more at a steady pace. Humans have to take breaks, have to sneeze, have to do all of these different things. So they're actually increasing the amount of human injuries that occur. Now, I suspect because she's telling me this story, I don't know, close to a year ago, there's lots of research going on in this. I'm sure lots of people are making improvements on how to fix that. But that's a really great example of something they did not foresee. Getting into that, you can crunch the numbers. I'm sure there are some ergonomics and human factors folks who are expert enough to figure it out. And some of you are probably thinking that too. But in general, that's a big issue that they're having to face with these new cobots.
That's a really interesting example of things that people need to think about before investing in smart manufacturing technologies. Do you have any? Because this is there's a big focus on learning some finance concepts in this course. Do you have some vivid examples of finance concepts that, if ignored, lead to disastrous financial
Well, and I really didn't finish my capital budgeting story because I told you the example of the payback. And that's kind of, to me, maybe a first step and a last step in doing it. And by the way, you can put time value of money to it if you want. But net present value is the gold standard. You know, I think this is net present value means I take all of the cash outflows that I'm going to put in it and figure out how long it's going to take me to spend that. And then all the cash flows, inflows from that same budget, put time value of money to it. And I'm going to take that all the way down and I'm going to get what's this going to be worth to me if I had that all that done today? What's my net present value? And obviously the projects that I'm comparing, the one with the highest net present value that meets my criteria, of course, is the one that's going to be selected. And in fact, I may be, and we'll look at examples where I'm looking at 4 or 5 or 6 projects, and maybe all of them will meet that hurdle rate of getting us, you know, a net present value that's going to be in the positive, that will give us our required rate of return, you know, in that time frame that we've allocated. You can also turn around and figure those expenses and put an internal rate of return on it. What is my actual, am I earning 13% on this investment, 15%, or is it only 3%? So those three are key that we'll look at. You know, the payback, which really more of a thumbnail, you know, rule of thumb kind of thing. The net present value, absolutely the standard everybody uses. Internal rate of return is another one that you just see everywhere.
Yeah. Do you have any cases that you like to use as examples of poor decision-making about implementing new technologies on the line or in the business?
You know, yeah. And I'll be careful not to use too many company names here, but, and I'm using a company name that is so incredibly worldwide successful, and that's SAP, that I'm not worried about harming them. And this is in the early stages of SAP implementation. And some of you are probably groaning because some of you are old enough like me to have lived through some of that, but that's an ERP, you know, economics requirements planning tool. You know, it is the tool that combines all of the things that we do in a manufacturing plant. And in fact, through the distribution channels as well. So I can cook up through my supplier and vendor partners with SAP if I want to. It's a great opportunity for companies to use this. Here's the problem. In the early days of implementing SAP, there were problems that would always occur with implementation of this. You know, what are the key task variables, the people and training variables? You know, what kind of software and hardware expertise do I have to implement this? Very expensive coding, specific elements of installing an SAP process for a manufacturing or a distribution plant for that matter. So, you know, there were some major companies during those early years of SAP that almost went out of business during, let's just say, Christmas and Easter, because the product that they were selling, that was there. You know, when you got 80% of your sales, depending on a, let's just say, confectionery product sold at Eastern chocolate, you get Eastern Christmas, you've got a big problem. And some of those companies almost went out of business. I can name some local ones who went almost out of business installing it. I had a grad student at the master's level do his thesis for one of the major manufacturers here in this county area. And that first year that they implemented SAP, they lost 80% of productivity just by virtue of doing that. And again, I'm going back probably 20 years with these examples. I tell that story because it is a famous story. There's tons of case studies. You can go out there and read about that. But it's also the kind of unpredictability that often goes with these kinds of new smart manufacturing plants, just like the cobot system, just like any financial decision that's brand new, there's going to be unpredictable elements of that that are very hard to see. You really can't, you know, whether it's automation variables, the person variables, the task variables, you have to do a really great job of analyzing those and being prepared for anything.
Kathy, this is fabulous. I feel like I need to be paying you for your expertise. So now I can go and open up a company, remember these things. So Kathy, as I kind of bring us home here in the summary, I think it sounds like there's really this three-legged stool here. And obviously finance is probably the biggest leg on the stool. But it sounds like there's some ethics and social responsibility that you've touched on today, as well as good planning for implementation as well. Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, the finance piece is a big chunk of it, but there's also these other pieces that it seems to be sometimes forgotten about. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct. And, you know, you put down there ethics and social responsibility. And of course, I automatically go to the definition of sustainability, because ethics and social responsibility is the people side of it. And it's not just that. It's, you know, when we're talking about sustainability, we're talking about how do we make decisions to take care of today's generation without sacrificing the future generations. That's kind of a big deal, because now I'm talking about, you know, yes, you mentioned the people. I've got to care about the social and ethics responsibility that I have to my employees, but I also have to think about this planet that we're on, so environmental concerns. Nowadays, when we're doing this planet, and smart manufacturing has to consider cradle to grave financing. What happens when we start installing more smart manufacturing? We're using up a lot more chips. We're using up a lot more elements, believe it or not, on our planet that aren't replaceable with ease. Batteries are an example. Some of you probably have expertise in and understand that, you know, we're perhaps at a tipping point in some of these with the raw materials that are going to be available. Using them at the rate we're now starting to install them, we have an ethical sustainability responsibility to look at that from an environmental standpoint. We can look at, I mentioned, I should say, the economic standpoint of it too. We hear in the news all the time of companies making poor decisions from a sustainability standpoint, spending too much on airplanes, not being wise with their workforce, perhaps stepping over the lines with what I'd call slave labor, you know, in other countries. We have a lot of potential dangers as you step into these big processing plants to take advantage of people working for us. We also go, and then the last one, of course, is the social, the people. So the three I mentioned, that three-legged stool from sustainability, is people, planets, and profit. And all of those to me relate to that ethics and social responsibility that you mentioned there. And of course, then the implementation is part of the phase for the people side as well. And lastly, of course, but not least, is that economic, that finance piece.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying then is finance is a huge piece of it, but it shouldn't be the only driving factor.
Absolutely. And in fact, nowadays, look, we're all under a lens. All of our, particularly the major manufacturers, are under a lens. Are we doing our job with sustainability? You can find apps for rating manufacturing plants and rating products on their sustainability. You can look up almost any product and say how they're doing on these elements that I just mentioned. And, you know, a lot of companies have paid the price and ended up on headlines because they've stepped over these lines. It's a big deal in this world and likely to get bigger over time.
Well, it sounds like there's some hidden numbers that we need to discuss throughout the course to make sure that people are keeping those in mind. And I think sustainability is one of those things.
That's exactly right.
Well, Kathy, this has been a blast. I hope your learners have enjoyed getting excited. I know I've got goosebumps thinking about the upcoming weeks, and we appreciate your time and your expertise and the wonderful examples.
Happy to do it. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.